Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 84 of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday night, Larry. What's going on?
Thank you, Andy. Good to be with you. Glad you had me back again.
I tried. It was hard. I had to reach out. I had to constantly prod and poke you just to get you to answer my calls. And finally, your phone was ringing off the hook, wasn't it?
It was definitely ringing off the hook.
We had a conversation about that.
Yeah, but anybody under 30 doesn't know what a phone and a hook is.
We don't have anybody in chat that could try and we could see if they know anything about a phone ringing off the hook. Do you want to tell them real quick what that might allude to? For our young listeners,
if they're under 30, that what it alludes to is in the old days, phones, the receiver used to go into a hook to disconnect the connection to the call
and, with real bells and shit.
And when you place the receiver in the hook, the weight of the receiver would bring the hook down, and that would terminate the call. And so if you keep calling a person and you couldn't reach them, that was an expression. The phone was ringing off the hook because they would ring and ring and ring and ring the phone. And the phone would literally ring. They had bells, and depending on car dealerships in certain places, gas stations would have these really, really loud bells where you could hear the phone ring.
Right.
So,
and that stuff was hardwired back to the phone company too. Like back in, I don't even, probably before 1985, you rented a phone from the phone company too.
Prior to the breakup of the Bell system, which that I believe took effect in January of 84, if I'm not mistaken, the phone company, which there were all these companies that were subsidiaries of the big phone company, which is AT&T, but they had all these regional names like Southern Bell, Mountain Bell, and Michigan Bell, and Bell Atlantic, and Pacific Bell and so forth, but they were all the phone company. And you got your local dial tone, you got your long distance, you got your yellow page advertisements for your businesses from the phone company. You rented your telephone set from the phone company, or you could purchase it later years. You could purchase a telephone set from the phone company, but everything went through the phone company, and the phone company knew everything about you.
Definitely. I have a clip for you to play, and I totally didn't prep you for this, so I hope you appreciate this. Here we go.
But the most important thing I found was going to the legislators' offices and sitting down and starting to make relationships with key players. I've learned over time that relationships is the catalyst to stop bad legislation or to get some positive legislation from your lawmakers.
What do you think?
It sounds familiar. I even detect a similar Southern accent, but that would be from the Narsal in Action conference called Thursday night. That would be Patrick McNally.
And what was he talking about though?
Well, he sounds familiar to the advice I give people about being effective in legislative arena, that you have to form a relationship. So it was something that of all the guests I have on Narsal in Action, he had absolutely no prep from me, because even though I sent him the questions in advance, he didn't open them. And he's been around long enough that he's been in the legislative arena to know that get a lot more done if they know you and if they respect you and they have a relationship with you. So it was kind of like, I was glad he said it, because I said, gee, that sounds familiar. I say that.
Yeah, so I wanted to grab that just so that you could speak to somebody else preaching your same words. And I know that it wasn't prepped or anything like that, so it was unsolicited. And that's the true meaning of edification, is when someone else says, well, I guess edification is when they say something nice about you. But in this case, he was speaking the same words.
Been practicing since, I think he said 1982 or three. And
it almost sounded like he said 1882. And then I was like, oh my God, you guys are peers. But he's been practicing. If he's been practicing since 82, and you wouldn't graduate from law school until your late 20s or something like that, oh my God, he's not a spring chicken.
The part of a 4-person team. We're going to talk about that a little bit later about that case. But yeah, yes, he's been around for a long time.
Well, let's move on then. So I'm gonna throw this out there. I guess for the late breaking news then, and let me turn that down because that's loud. The late breaking news would be that Acosta, which is the Secretary of Labor, I believe is correct. He is a former federal prosecutor from Florida, and he has stepped down. And I guess we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute also. And then the extension of the TRO in Tennessee. Tell us about that real quick, Larry.
Well, the temporary restraining order in Tennessee was a phenomenal achievement. The people in Tennessee who had convictions against a victim under 12, they were on the verge of being evicted from their homes on July 1st. And four attorneys came together and filed an action in late June. And they got on the pleading alone, they got a temporary restraining order. And then normally the progression of that is that they schedule a hearing for a preliminary injunction as quickly as practical after that. So they had an injunction hearing set for the 11th of July. And on the 10th of July, they They had an agreement with the state that they would, that the state would not contest the continuation of the TRO. So the order that was put in place on June 28th was continued for the duration of this litigation. So therefore, no one is in jeopardy of being removed until this litigation runs its course. And anyone who has moved should contact the agency that instructed them to move and ask them if they are familiar with this temporary restraining order, which is on the NARSL website, by the way, a copy of it in case they say they've never heard of it.
Okay. Well, that's, I mean, yeah, I mean, so that's good news. I don't want to like give me the big sigh. It's just, I asked you this question. So across the street from me, they are just finishing building a couple churches. And my question to you was, if I had been one of the people that was notified about having to go away and then the TRO goes into place where I could then go back home, but I've left my, my handlers told me that, I could stay. I was here first, but if I ever leave, I probably won't be able to come back. What do you think? Would I be able to come back after having left and found like new residence, whatever?
Well, under the specific set of facts that you described, I believe you would have the lawful authority to come back as far as the state statute was concerned. The question would be whether a person under supervision, if they would decide that since you had found what they liked is better housing, would they let you go back? Would they approve another change of address back to where you were? But as far as anyone who left in Tennessee merely because the sheriff told them, who's the enforcement of the registry requirements, if anyone left solely on that, it would be my legal opinion that with the temporary restraining order in effect, they could go back. But if you're under supervision and the PO says,
well, right,
I don't want you back over there because now you found a better place, then the question becomes a little bit murkier. Can the PO give you an order to live at a place that's more to their liking? I don't know. We'll have to find out.
I'm, you know, housing is hard enough to find as it is. And then to then find a second place, even if it was temporary, like, hey, can I go crash on your couch? And then I can't go back to where I was because it was adequate at the time. But then, oh my God, I got grandfathered in. I get, you know, I had like the first presence here and then they showed up and then I had to leave and come back. It's like it gets taken out from underneath you.
Well, now see, when you voluntarily leave, that's a whole different set of facts than being forced out. I've seen that litigation before where a person argues because they were grandfathered in that they could leave the nonconforming address and that they could continue to live at nonconforming addresses throughout the state. And that went nowhere because that would be a grandfathering to always be in noncompliance. So the appellate court, I believe that might have been in Arkansas, but the appellate court said, no, it doesn't work it that way. You're grandfathered in as long as you stay put. But once you no longer stay put, then the regulation that you were grandfathered in applies to you when you move. So I think if you left voluntarily, I don't think you'd be able to come back under any circumstances. But if you leave because you've been ordered to leave, that creates a whole different fact pattern about whether you'd be able to come back. I think unless the probation could have a really good reason for you not to go back, I think you could go back.
All right. Oh, God. This is just always terrible. I just hate it. It just makes no sense to me that
when we play our Scalia on the law, I think that what he says will illuminate a little bit more on this about some things we just have to wait and see.
Right. Sure. Sure.
Whether it can be done or not.
Well, we have, some exciting segments to cover, and we have a mountain of articles. So are you ready to get started?
Ready.
Absolutely. Here we go. The first one comes from WSB out of Atlanta. And this one, we're not going to spend a lot of time, but I do have a clip to play. Tag reading cams going up at these schools to catch speeders, and wait for it, and sex offenders. Here's a little clip.
Officials are also working to allow the cameras access to the statewide offender database. That way, the cameras can read tags and alert police of sex offenders who enter the school zones.
Tag, so it's not just speed cameras, it's also a twofold. It also acts as a safety measure for the school zones as well.
So, yeah, we got to keep our kids safe, and we're going to track any sex offenders moving through the area also.
I thought that was really, really shocking because, first of all, I think those who are listening who actually don't click on the view, the people interviewed are minority African-American, but they're just as conservative and protective of their children as any white person you would ever hear.
Right.
The fact of the matter is there's no prohibition against driving through a school zone. I mean, as far as the registry itself. Now, there may be probationers who've been told that you can't go within a certain radius of a school for any circumstances. And then some people end up having to take loops around and take detours. But as far as just going about your normal everyday life, there's nothing wrong with going through a school zone.
There is a provision on the probation restrictions that says you will never drive alone, especially where children are known to congregate, including, you know, schools, parks, playgrounds, et cetera.
Well, then in some places, if there's only one street that gets you where you're going, right, and goes by school, what would you do?
You would get out and put your car like the Jetsons, where you'd fold it up into a suitcase, and then you'd walk around through the dirt roads and through the woods and whatnot. And then when you get past the area, then you could unfold your car and keep going.
Uh-huh. I don't see think that would work. That. I don't see a problem with it.
There's another article that we have right behind it coming out of Slate. It says license plate readers are creeping into neighborhoods across the country. Cheap surveillance software is changing how landlords manage their tenants and what police can enforce. So, you know, I'm just pointing this out because, I mean, I have security cameras here at my house and they're $20 a pop, and they just put in some artificial intelligence stuff that it knows when it sees a person versus a cat or a car driving by, so it can detect those differences. You know, for $20, that's what you get. It is not very difficult to put in the facial recognition stuff and then start tracking down where everyone is going. This puts us right up against 1984 and other kinds of dystopian futures like that too.
Yeah, the license plate readers, there's a whole issue of what to do with that data when it's collected, how long it can be kept, and how it can be utilized, and who can have access to it. I know it's going to be a major area where the technology has gotten ahead of the statutes. The lawmakers in part-time legislatures were not thinking about when the cops are spending these enormous budgets getting new technology that are being shown in national conferences about the latest tools in law enforcement. The legislators were not thinking about how they'd be misused, because the cops never misuse anything, right?
Of course not. They're Puritans.
It's only years later that after we start hearing about them parking in front of a hotel and running everybody, every guest, and then knocking at doors at 11:30 at night, 12:30 at night, and giving people a hard time. Then we say, well, gee, that's not what we thought they were. We thought they were going to go out and break real crime rings and stuff. So this rapidly evolving technology is going to take some time for both the statutes and the decisions from the courts to catch up. And decisions of the courts are probably going to be the least helpful, because you don't have an expectation of privacy that's long established when you're out in public. So snapping a picture of your license plate is not going to be the problem. What you do with it and how you act with once you've gotten it, whether you can run it through a criminal records database and whether you can make contact with that person, whether that constitutes probable cause, there's a whole lot of things that we don't know the answer to yet, because it hasn't been litigated. But merely snapping your life, I do that all day long. I don't need anybody's permission. I can go out there and start doing it with an old-fashioned camera with my cell phone. If you don't right. want your license plate snapped, you can stay off the street.
So
that's not the problem. It's what happens with the information, how it's stored and how it's disseminated, and what actions are taken as a result of what they find out, particularly people who can convert that readily to an identity. An average person, if I snap your license plate number, I can't do anything with it.
Sure.
I can't even convert that. If I'm not a tow truck operator or an insurance agent or something where I have access to NVD records, convert that. But the police can, and all arms of law enforcement, even court personnel can convert that stuff out easily to who it belongs to.
Let's move over to this article from The Intercept, where our favorite prosecutor, Larry Krasner, he's actually now getting hit back by a Republican legislature that they're reducing. I know, right? They're reducing his level of power for him to be this super progressive criminal justice reform advocate person.
I thought the Republicans were in favor of local control.
Larry, if you keep up that attitude, you're going to drive away every listener we have.
You have to. Why did you put such a distorted fake news article in here?
Frankly, I think you put it there. Well, you know, I mean, just to catch people up. So we have Larry Krasner, who's the DA of Philadelphia, and he's running through the sweeping changes of one of the ones that I recall is if the prosecutor wants to put someone in prison for something that would be more than, like, I think 3 years, the prosecutor has to write down how, like, $40,000 a year times the person's going to get a 10-year sentence. Is the crime that the person has committed, is it worth $400,000? You'd be like, no, he stole $2,500 from a local liquor store. So you're going to charge the city, the state $400,000 for something of $2,500. It doesn't really make sense. So, you know, that was one of the things that he was trying to put in and, like, go for the minimum kind of sentences. Are there alternative paths? So here the legislature is trying to reduce his ability to do these things.
Well, and not only they tried, they did. And in fairness, it was also signed by a Democratic governor
right. And
a Republican-dominated legislature. But what they did is they gave the attorney general concurrent jurisdiction over certain offenses, so that if the Philadelphia district attorney, who's elected by the citizens of Philadelphia, doesn't want to prosecute that, the big old bad state government can come in and prosecute it anyway. And the Democrats are crying foul now. They're saying that it was a maneuver at the last minute and that they didn't understand that this House Bill 1614 did what it actually does. And I have some level of sympathy for that, because in the rapidly moving legislative environment, things do sometimes not get fully vetted. And this thing can get through. But if that was actually the case, I have just a little bit of sympathy, not a lot. What you should have done is you should have gone to your governor and said, hey, we got snookered. The Republicans outsmarted us on this, and you need to veto this. And persuade the governor to veto it. And then, of course, the analysis would become, do they have sufficient strength to override the governor? Because if they felt that they were anywhere near close to a override, they would do an override vote just to embarrass people that would vote in favor of criminals. Okay. And people don't understand an override vote. You end up in an awkward position because you're having to decide whether you want to uphold your executive or not, which means you might have voted for the legislation and then the executive said, please sustain my veto, and you turn around and vote to sustain the veto. But in this case, the Republicans would have relished in being able to put the heat on the Democratic governor to veto this so they could attempt an override, because then they could portray him as soft on crime and him being for the criminal, and that we're trying to protect you so that with these runaway district attorneys who choose not to do their job, we can save you by bringing in the powers and the resources of the state so that we can prosecute these, because the DA there in Philadelphia is not going to do the job and the people there were stupid. But like I say, it goes contrary to what they claim that they believe, which they claim they say that the local people always know best. But magically, on a lot of things, they do a flip-flop like they do on minimum wage and things. When you let a local community, like in the case of St. Louis, Missouri, they enacted a higher minimum wage, and they said, well, no, we trust these people. And they preempted local control over minimum wage. So they preach local control, but magically, there's times when they completely abandon that local control. And this is an example of that in real time.
And I'm not sure how you worded this before. Is this another one of those cases where the governor just has to sign it? There's just an overwhelming support in the legislature that it would go, like, you know, we've talked about this from, like, the sex offender laws, that the governor just has to sign it. You'd have to kill it before it gets there.
I don't know the margins. I'm assuming, since it said it was bipartisan, I'm assuming it passed with relatively little opposition. But the real test would have been, what are the margins of the Republican majorities? How close are they to being at override level? And how ugly this would have been had they tried an override. And they would have said to the citizens of Pennsylvania, this is why you don't want to live in Philadelphia. We've got this runaway prosecutor that's making his own law, and he won't enforce the laws of the Commonwealth. And we're trying to bring a civilized behavior back to Pennsylvania, to Philadelphia, to our largest city. And you really need to vote with us to override it. And there would have been a lot of Democrats who have been under a lot of pressure to override, even if there's not a supermajority already. And I don't think there is a supermajority. I think it's actually much closer in Pennsylvania. But let's just take a look and see what the ratios are.
While you're doing that, I was listening to something in the last couple of days ago of talking about collective bargaining. And the reason why I'm bringing that up is because down here towards the bottom of the article, there's a Twitter post from the True Blue Warriors. And it says, "Help wanted, Philadelphia Police Union calling for new district attorney." And as far as I know, the information that we have covered on this is that the crime hasn't changed, but they have reduced the number of prisons, so they've shut down prisons, which would definitely affect the police union and at least their peers, their cousins, as being like the prison guard, if that's even unionized in that particular area. I would guess it is. Where I was going with this is, it feels to me that, God, how do you say that a union shouldn't be able to advertise like this? This doesn't feel right to me that they are making this kind of statement.
Well, I've never had tremendous respect for law enforcement unions. I have great respect for labor unions, but I've never really considered the law enforcement unions to be the equivalent of a labor union in the traditional sense. So I'm not surprised.
And the reason why this feels scuzzy to me is because these people are very closely tied to where these laws are being written, and they have very close ties to the DAs and so forth. It's not the same. To me, it feels as though that's not the same for me to go try and talk to the DA that a cop would have much more ready access and a more friendlier, amicable relationship with that person for them to push forward. And now the union being collective, they can go block vote much easier than we can, it feels.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The Republicans control the state Senate. They're about 28 to 22. It's a 50-seat Senate. And they control the House by 110 to 93. So it's much more evenly divided in the House. But like I say, there would be enormous pressure. The governor's office, if he chose to veto it, would be facing enormous pressure. He would be actually not facing, but he would be putting forth enormous pressure to sustain his veto on those. And the Republicans would be putting enormous pressure trying to get to that magic 2/3. And they would be, the people that were voting to sustain the governor would be quite well aware that this was going to be a campaign issue in the next election cycle, that they voted with the criminals. And so this would be one of those things where the governor would possibly burn political capital by making a stand on a veto, which would be overridden because there'd be no way that they wouldn't be able to get to the 2/3. And the one way you could figure that out would be look at the margin it passed at the beginning. So this may be an example of where it's kind of like with the International Magnus Law. There was no way that a president was going to veto that in 2016, in election year, but he couldn't run anymore. And he would be leaning on his people he can't help very much to say, please sustain me. And they would have said, no, sir, we're not going to sustain you. We're going to override you because we're not going to be vilified for protecting sex offenders. So this may be one of those things where the governor felt like he just didn't want to burn any capital on this because he was going to lose. And I know you're supposed to do the right thing.
So aren't they supposed to fall on their swords for the right thing? And that's why we have elected them.
So that's the theory, but it's not the reality of politics.
You want to take a little.
You can't stay in the office doing the right thing.
That's a really disturbing kind of statement. You can't stay in office doing the right things. You have to stay in office doing. I get the answer is what the people want.
That's correct. You have to serve the will of the people to stay in office.
No matter how idiotic and moronic and stupid and assholic they are?
With some exceptions, but yes, if you don't represent the will of people in the democratically elected system, you're not going to be elected very long.
Yeah, I understand. Hey, let's take a drive over to Kansas real quick. And Kansas's take on insanity defense to face high court test. This is from Law 360. This is you describe it as another attempt at chipping away at anybody ever using any sort of insanity defense, I believe.
That is what I said. The not spend a lot of time on it. This is an insanity defense is very rarely asserted. There's already been great changes since 1981 when Reagan was shot. The standards, which were already tough, have gotten even tougher. And then Kansas wants to make it even tougher, and they want to to have it where if the state can show that you acted purposely or willfully, that's all it takes. So you could, what's confusing to that people, you can purposely do something and not understand that it's wrong. So in an insanity defense, the general rule is, can you distinguish the difference between right and wrong? You can purposely cut a telephone line, but that doesn't mean that you know that your mind is so diseased or defective. You may not know that you're doing something wrong. So we're convoluting the issue. You can purposely do something, but it doesn't mean that you can understand the criminality of what you're doing. So they want to eliminate the not understanding the being able to distinguish the difference between right and wrong, that you just act purposely or willfully to do the act, and then you can't assert an insanity defense. So basically no one would ever have a chance of using an insanity defense in Kansas.
And my understanding of what this would be is someone with a very depleted intellectual capacity, low IQ, however you want to get there, does something heinous, and they say, I mean, is that where we're headed with this? Or are we talking like someone walks in on their wife banging the neighbor and you lose your mind and you kill everybody? Which way are we going?
I think we've pretty well gotten rid of that a long time ago. That was the irresistible impulse what people
bit of rage,
temporary insanity. I think that's already gone. But this is where if you can do something that you ought not do, but not appreciate the impact or the criminality of that. This is taking away the inability to appreciate the criminality of your act. Just simply, if you intentionally did whatever you did, that's enough.
Okay. I mean, intentionally, don't we all pretty much intentionally do everything that we do?
Well, mostly, but not everything we do. Sometimes you possess drugs that your teenage son put in your purse that you didn't intentionally do. But
okay.
But as a general rule, yes, you intentionally, but you may not understand because of your mental state that right. What you're doing is criminal. You could fill the bathtub up with water and put the baby in it, not know that you're going to kill the baby if you're so defective, but you intentionally fill the bathtub up with water.
Right. Right. All right. So Andrea Yates wouldn't be able to get an insanity plea for sure. I mean, granted, she did correct. Do five yes. of her kids you know, continue to do them after the first and the second and so forth.
So you wouldn't be able to say you heard voices in your head or anything like that. As long as you acted purposely or willfully to do that, you're not insane.
All right, I'm going to avoid going down the path of where I shouldn't go, of hearing voices and responding to those voices. I'm going to avoid that. Well, then we also have an article from the Collateral Consequences Resource Center. That is really hard to say. So it's ccresourcecenter.org. New restoration laws take center stage in second quarter of 2019. Larry, this is way more words than I'm ever going to read for an article. So can you please explain to me what this is?
I would just urge people to read it because it's helping to see that there's a trend developing across the nation for have been convicted of crimes or even been arrested and not convicted to diminish the sting and the consequences. There are dozens of states who have taken modest and sometimes significant measures in the last year or two. So this is just an illumination of the trend, including my state. We passed a limited expungement bill, which just took effect on July 1st. So it's a trend it's a favorable trend. We don't get a lot of good news on this podcast. This is just some good news for people to peruse through and see if they live in one of those states, and there might be something that would help you. And of course, usually those convicted of sexual offenses are exempt, but you never know. It might help you, or it might help someone you know.
Okay. Well, cool. Yes. And like I said, it's not an Atlantic article, because those take you like a matter of days to read, but this one is decent size. And then quickly, we're going to jump over to the Reason magazine. And the reason why I'm jumping through these so quick, just for you, so you know, is there's so much stuff we have to cover at the end that I want to get through these things. But from Reason magazine, the Defense Department computer network among top sharers of child pornography. This just boggles my mind that something of 20% of the child porn that's hosted on the internet is hosted by the United States government. And I don't think I can come up really with a parallel kind of example of there being criminal content or criminal activity that the government is like they're hosting the symposium on drug dealing, And then you show up to the drug dealer symposium and they arrest you right there on the, I can't figure out how this one works.
I can't figure it out either, Andy.
Can you think of anything that is remotely similar to it?
No, I think we should go into a Discord and see if anybody else knows about this, because I can't.
So far, they're just making smiley faces at me because I listen to a boatload of tech podcasts, and I've heard this over, and obviously not related to our issue, but as it being a technology thing. So being in possession of the content is considered like a crime. Then viewing it is then considered a crime. These people are then distributing it, but then coming back on us and putting us in prison for 5 years per offense or some crazy shit like that. And these people have all of it.
Well, what's the problem baffled. With that?
Come on. I'm baffled at how we get here and how this works. Tell me just like off the top of your head, what could we do to have this not be a thing?
Pray.
Okay, so you went there to the voices. All right, we should move on. That it doesn't seem right that we should have these server farms set up.
Well, I don't understand all the stuff that's happening here, but it says that there's a bill been introduced. Did you see that? Who co-sponsored the bill by Representative?
I totally
Abigail.
Didn't see that. Okay, I do see the Abigail Spangberger.
Spangberger and co-sponsored by Representative Mark Meadows.
Okay, so we have bipartisan support.
It says the notion that Department of Defense Network and Pentagon issue computers may be used to view, create, or circulate such horrifying images, shameful disgrace, and one we might want to fight head on. So there's some legislation apparently.
All right, well, that's
attempting to deal with that. So I guess we could support the legislation if it's good legislation.
Okay. And so then by that, by extension, we should call those representatives and we should say that we support the bill, provided that it has the right text and so forth, and doesn't criminalize all the other things.
We should have some of our people that are listening to the podcast analyze the legislation, and then we can decide if we would want to advocate supporting it.
Hey, speaking of the Atlantic, the next article actually does come from the Atlantic. I didn't even do that on purpose. And this article is Jeffrey Epstein cases like nothing I've seen before. So that was part of the breaking news part we covered at the top. Is it Jim Acosta? What's the Secretary of Labor's name?
His first name, Manuel Acosta, I believe.
Oh, Manuel Acosta. Okay, I'm sorry. And he's the former Florida prosecutor that prosecuted this case. And Jeffrey Epstein got. Just from what I'm hearing, Larry, he got a ridiculously easy sentence. And he got like 13 months in county. He had 12 hours of work release where he went to his office. He's a billionaire. He was taken by his driver. And the officer stood outside where his normal business operations continued, including women going to his office every day or, you know, whatever. And then he would go home at night. And so that was 6 days a week that he was allowed to do that. I'd like a prison sentence like that.
Well, but see, I don't know if we're going to get into this in great detail in the subsequent segment, but prosecution is a tough business. And because an ethical prosecutor, if there is such a thing, and I know there are, because I've met a few, you have the duty to try to do justice. So you're not supposed to prosecute cases where there's not evidence to convict beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, that's ideal. But the reality is sometimes you want a conviction, even though you don't believe you have evidence that would win beyond a reasonable doubt, because you believe that that person needs to be under the thumb of the authorities so that they can be monitored. And so that hopefully you're praying that they violate the conditions, because the standard for putting them in prison is much lower after they're convicted. So oftentimes when a prosecutor gets criticized for a sweetheart deal, they were giving a deal based on a very, very weak case, but yet they wanted to have the person in the system. So they're willing to make a deal. I get this from mothers all the time when they call. They'll say, well, my son, all he did was X, Y, and Z. And I said, well, that is a crime in the state of Arizona.
And you are a person, right?
Right. And I say, when the police came out to talk to him about the consensual sex, he was very cooperative. So he admitted that he had the sex. He admitted that he knew the person was underage. Yes, he did all that. Okay. Well, the prosecution had a very good case. Now, does your son read and write? Yes. Does he understand the English language? Yes. Did he finish high school? Yes. So he would not be able to claim any disability in interrogation when they said you have the right to remain silent and you have the right. He would understand those Miranda warnings. Well, yes. Well, then getting your son's confession set aside is going to be very, very difficult. We can make the motion, but it's not going to probably work. So they've got an open shut case. Well, then there's another son where the mother calls me and says, well, what do I do? Well, you've got a really good case because when they came to see your son, he told the police, go pound sand. And he says, I'm not admitting anything. And it wasn't reported for 6.5 months. And there was no forensics evidence at all. And they have a very weak case against your son. They have the evidence of the accusing party. So now we've got a whole different set of circumstances here. So we've got a case where if we go to trial here, there's a good chance we may get a hung jury. We may even get a straight out acquittal of not guilty. But the state's offering, in this case, they're offering your son a probated sentence. So we can be certain that he won't get any prison time at all. And in fact, they're offering him a non-sex offense. They're offering him contributing to delinquency of a minor, which is not a registrable sex offense. And it's 3 years of supervised probation. And then he's even there. The prosecution's willing to even stipulate that he can get a conditional discharge, which means that it'll be off his record if he completes the 3 years. So now, if you want to roll the dice and see if the citizens of Sandoval County are going to convict him based on her credibility, you can roll the dice. But if you lose, he's going to at least have to register as a sex offender, and he may get prison time. Possibly, we don't know for sure because it's all going to be decided at sentencing later. But we have the certainty here, and we have the uncertainty of the jury. What do you want to do? Well, that's what happens in a lot of cases where people see a sweetheart deal. Well, the sweetheart deal was offered because it was a very weak case, and the ages were identical of the boys. The age was identical of the girls, of the young men and the young women. The ages were identical. It was a 21-year-old boy and a 15-year-old girl in both cases. And the girl was 1 year too young to give consent. But one confessed and one didn't. And they say, well, that just ain't right. Well, it may not be right, but that's the hand that the prosecutor was dealt. Your son didn't do what he should do, and the other son did what he should have done. And therefore, the prosecutor is in a much weaker position, and the prosecutor has to make a deal. The prosecutor can say, all right, well, I'm going to take a principal position. We're going to go to trial on this thing, by golly, and we're going to get a sex offense and a registration, or we're going to get nothing. And they walk out embarrassed at the end of a 4-day trial. The jury finds not guilty, and they return a verdict in 37 minutes after deliberations begin. And the person they're not in the system at all. Well, so on the scenario of the sweetheart deal, they're in the system, and then they pray to God that they can revoke the person during the 3 years and take away their conditional discharge and send them to prison.
Sure. first correction, the attorney's name is Alex Acosta. Just wanted to backtrack on that.
Okay. Not bad. Okay.
This guy is a billionaire in something that I was listening to. I didn't realize that he's a math phenom, so to speak. He didn't even finish college, but he has been a teacher, a professor of mathematics at various things, hedge fund manager. I mean, the guy is not a stupid individual by any stretch of the imagination. He's a smart, smart cat. But my first thing, because of that, he is a billionaire. How much of that do you think that he has the influence in the prosecution system of donating money to various candidates to try and get them to put pressure on prosecution to make things a lighter deal? He would be able to have the attorneys of the century, so to speak. How much do you think that weighs into him getting this deal of the century?
It would have the potential to weigh very heavily, because you not only, as a prosecutor, you generally don't have unlimited funds, although you generally do have more funds than your opponent, than the defendant does. But in this case, the prosecution starts out being out-resourced, because very few prosecutions warrant spending millions of dollars. Very few.
Yeah. This guy would totally be able to outspend the budget, this is Mar-a-Lago.
this would be where they would be evenly matched, or the defendant would outmatch them. But also the connections have a lot to do. When the district attorney is getting phone calls saying, hey, this guy has been a charitable, donating tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to charity, and he's done this, he's done that, that is a potential consideration. The truth is, none of us know. We don't know. And I get as irritated when we do the same thing that we get mad at having done to us. We don't have any evidence that I'm aware of that says there was anything crooked done by Acosta, that he was influenced by any of these things. We have the statement that it was the best that could be done under the circumstances, considering all the relevant factors. Well, I, for one, don't want to be an intellectual hypocrite. I don't want to constantly go back and use mob rule and public anger to second guess a judicial decision like was done in the Brock Turner case and more recently another case, which the name is escaping me. But I don't want to, when we go down that road, then we're in dangerous territory. When decisions are going to be subject to mob justice and second and third guess years later. You know, that's what we gave. We claim we want prosecutorial discretion. Why is it we get so darn angry when someone actually exercises a little bit of prosecutorial discretion? That's what's puzzling me.
I'm with you. And the only other, like, I'm just to expand on the way that this sentence was structured, do you think that this is unusual? It says, in exchange for the Southern District of Florida's abandonment of its criminal investigation of Epstein's conduct, agreed to not prosecute him federally, and incredibly agreed not to prosecute anyone else who helped him procure underage girls for sex. Like, it just, it feels like, what?
I don't feel it's that unusual at all. There's really? there's constant agreements between federal and local federal and state authorities, which is going to take the prosecution. And it's not that unusual at all for them to defer and say, if they prosecute him for the same offense federally, they got convicted of state, they would be saying, well, isn't that double jeopardy? Which it isn't. But wouldn't we be beefing and jerking and moaning and crying about double jeopardy? You can't win. But I don't think it's all that unusual.
We did have a Supreme Court decision about that double jeopardy thing, right?
Well, yes, it's not double jeopardy. The feds could have prosecuted him. But we get mad. Well, how many phone calls have I taken? Well, I don't want you to know, Larry. My son was prosecuted by the state of Tennessee, and then the feds came in and filed charges. Well, wait a minute. Isn't that well, why is it okay for Epstein to be double prosecuted for the same offense? But yet you're against that.
Right.
Well, the difference is, I can tell you what the difference is. The difference is you're angry because he's got money, yes, and it looks like he got away with something, and there's a perception of injustice, and something's got to be done about it. That's the difference.
And we have seen this, we were talking about earlier, of a handful of other cases where someone with immense social presence, you know, a famous actor or, you know, music star, whatever, that they've gotten very light sentences out of the whole equation.
Yes. We talk about light sentences all the time, and it's strange to me that it makes our people so angry that someone gets a sentence that supposedly we're for individual analysis of each defendant. How do you square those conflicting statements?
Would the prosecutor have as close to a perfect outlook of what evidence is available to make that determination as anybody?
Well, I don't know who would have theoretically the defense has all the evidence, but it's the prosecutor's discretionary call. The prosecutor is going to know what juries in their jurisdiction are more likely to convict on, or what levels of evidence they're going to require and what they're going to find is credible. You kind of know if all of your people drive tractors and have ninth grade educations, and they say, well, if the police say he done it, reckon he did do it. Or, you know, if your people are much more educated, they're going to be demanding more forensics analysis, and they're going. You know the expectations of jurors. If you prosecute Boulder, you know you're not going to convict anybody of drug possession. Probably in Denver as well, you're not going to convict them. They don't care about that. So a prosecutor's in the best position to know whether or not he or she can get a conviction based on the evidence that they have. Now, I guess what people are saying, they want the prosecutor to bring cases regardless of whether there's evidence that's sufficient to convict beyond a reasonable doubt, which is so inconsistent with what we claim that we're angry about, that people bring a charge, prosecutors bring charges on the flimsiest evidence. You can't have it both ways. Which is it?
And the funny thing there is that, you know, at the same time we're doing we were just talking about Larry Krasner and them squashing his ability to do all the reform stuff. Yeah, I'm with you. And then we talk about judicial activism, and then where the legislators, where their line is. And we're supposed to have these three co-equal branches, and the lines are already delineated, and the prosecutor has done what he's allowed to do.
That is correct. And I think it's very dangerous if we're going to start reopening every case.
Well, tell me, cover that for a minute. What about, you mentioned that to me during the week of how this is dangerous. Tell me how this is dangerous if we second guess what the prosecutor has done.
Well, you do get to second guess what the prosecutor has done when they're elected by the people. You simply don't elect them again. That's one way you get to. But if we can start opening up old cases and saying you should have done this rather than this, then pretty soon we're going to have a system where it's robotic justice, where there's not going to be any discretion, because if the prosecutor has to be worried constantly about mob justice, and if this is perceived wrong, even though it's the right thing to do, then I better not do it, then we're in dangerous territory.
Well, we already know that judges aren't safe depending on the state. So now prosecutors aren't safe depending on the state. Like, what is the solution?
Well, the solution, it's not going to happen in my lifetime. The solution is for us as people to become better informed and realize that these decisions are not for us to make. We're not capable as a people sitting back as a Monday morning quarterback to examine the evidence that's available to a prosecution to determine whether they have enough to convict someone beyond a reasonable doubt, going through affording the due process protections that are required by our Constitution. And sometimes something's not going to look right to us, and we're going to have to accept the fact that the people we elected did the best that they could, or if they were appointed, or however they got in office. Rather than, we have all this skepticism that everything's crooked. Now, I don't like to buy into all this conspiracy stuff until I have some evidence. Is it possible that Alex Acosta was influenced improperly? Yes, it's possible, but you haven't shown me the evidence yet.
Right. You have a lot of circumstantial that he's tight with these people, he's got all this money, et cetera.
Yeah. I'm one of those who likes to see evidence. You know.
Sure. I'm with you.
I'm hardwired defense, and I like to see evidence, and I like to presume that people are not guilty of anything unless there's evidence that shows that they are. I don't like to guilt by association and by innuendo. It would be inconsistent for me to be as strong as I am for the defense and to say that I'm ready to throw Acosta under the bus without any evidence. I mean, I don't like the administration that he worked for, but that has nothing to do with whether there's evidence that he did anything wrong.
Yeah. And not that I know that we're covering this from the side that we're going back and analyzing Alex Acosta for his actions and then him stepping down. But I don't think that his current situation of his current crimes, Jeffrey Epstein, I don't think the registry did anything to prevent that. And also that, I think I lost my second point, but the registry did do anything to keep him from doing whatever he's being accused of now. And so I'm not, you know, this doesn't help. It certainly doesn't help our situation by him being so high profile and having more charges, him already being on the registry. But so that's just one of the points that I wanted to bring up.
There's so much in the way of possible new allegations and the runs that they've already filed. Are these allegations of sexual misconduct that occurred since his previous conviction, or these subsequent actions, or these actions before, or I've not followed it close enough.
Yeah. I just know that he's been giving a lot of money to young girls to have, to do things with him.
but once he became a convicted person, has this conduct been subsequent to that or before that?
Because these are allegations coming out of New York. So I can't even speak to that. I don't know the answer to that question.
Does anybody in Discord of our 100 people listening know the answer to that?
I will find out. They will chime in here whenever they decide that they want to chime in. Is there anything else that you want to cover about this before we move on?
Not at the moment. I think we'll probably pick it up again later.
Yeah. Well, then from the Tallahassee Democrat, prosecutor who sparked Jackson County drug planting probe resigns as whistleblower. I don't think that they make these titles very, like, they're hard to read. They almost sound like Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers. It's hard to say sometimes. This is I guess what has been going on is deputies in certain circumstances have been planting drugs on people, and the body cameras and the other surveillance stuff seems to indicate that they had done this. And so she's whistleblowing about this. And, it has created kind of a stink, and now she has resigned out of the whole thing.
You don't say that a sworn law enforcement officer would plant drugs on someone. Are you making that accusation?
Well, the header of the article then says 119 cases have been dropped as investigation into fire deputy continues, and she says, "I don't want to work in an environment that allows this to happen." So I'm going to then assume that the answer is yes. And there's even a picture of the officer holding a little baggie of something in his hand. And says, it shows the officer as seen on dash cam. So yeah, apparently the cop is planting stuff and it's being swept under the rug. So the whistleblower person's like, F this, I'm out.
Oh, Well, I would just have to say that that's one prosecutor who actually takes their ethical oath seriously to do justice.
But she's also then stepping down out of the whole thing.
Well, but apparently she can't do justice.
If the people that can make changes, that can affect these situations, if they then step down, then who mans the fort for the next one, for the next person that has drugs planted on them?
Well, I actually looked over this article, so I haven't read it, and I'm having trouble opening it. But was this the elected DA, state's attorney, or was this an assistant?
Christina Pumphrey started hearing whispers about Jackson County Deputy Zachary Wester not long after joining the state's attorney's office. So she's just a prosecutor. She's not the attorney general.
Apparently, so I'm a state's attorney. So apparently she cannot make those changes. And even if you are the elected prosecutor, people don't understand the vast amount of power that the police have and how scary and frightening they are. Ask our former district attorney here from Bernalillo County, Kara Brandenburg, when she prosecuted the cops that shot James Boyd off the side of the mountain a few years ago. Ask her about the death threats. Ask her about the untruth things that were said about her by certain police officers, it's not easy to take on the vast bureaucracy of the police.
It says that after she heard warnings about the officer, she started taking a closer look at the traffic stop arrest. And these are in like simple drug possession cases. She read his reports and had a habit of pulling the body camera videos, and she noticed something was off. Among other things, his written accounts of the stops didn't always match what she could see with her own eyes on the body camera footage. I know, right? All right. Well, I'm done. I'm done. We can shut the podcast down. We have solved all the problems of the world, right?
You don't say a police officer would not write an inconsistent statement down with what's on the body cam. That would not happen.
Let me tie it back to that billboard of the Larry Krasner thing. This is like, I mean, these people, we are trusting them with an immense amount of power, and then they're going to then run political ads and then lobby for potentially to make the punishment harsher and lower the threshold so that they can, you know, nab more people doing things illegal. It's too much like nepotism to me. It's too much like it's in the family. It's incest, so to speak. That's how it feels.
How it feels to me as well.
So I'm not insane in how I'm, someone says you can't fix stupid. So I'm not nuts in my thought process here on how I'm thinking about this.
That's on this particular thing. No.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So other things I am considered nuts. So then can we set up some sort of government, non-government agency that can monitor the police just kind of generically, like randomly select and audit certain things without having that turn into a political nightmare?
Very difficult. That's always the question of how the police believe they should oversee themselves.
I think that that's just a shitty idea right from the start.
But that's what they have strong support for that. The police are they should self monitor.
I don't see how you could do that. I don't even think that you could have take another state group, you know, police force, something like that, bring them over so that they're not politically tied. They're not tied to the same sort of promotion structure. They're still going to like scratch each other's back, at least to some degree, because they don't want to look down on their brotherhood. They're not going to, you know, they're going to scratch back on the other direction.
I'm just simply stating what is and not what should be.
Yeah,
the police
believe
and have enormous political power that they should be self-oversight. Anytime you try to bring the radical idea that the citizens that they work for should oversee them, there should be severe oversight, they go totally ballistic and they put all sorts of fear-mongering out about how that the people who don't understand policing will come in and neuter their powers. And they will make them so that no one will want to be a police officer. And then you'll be subject to all these criminals who will that will have anarchy. And the police generally win that argument with the public. Because in order to have civilian oversight, you have to make a political decision. And the political decision is you have to tell the people that you pay their salaries that we're going to tell you how to police. And the police do not like to be told how to police.
But they do work for the public, right?
I know it's an amazing concept. Every other place that has an employer, you get to, the employer gets to dictate the terms of the work, but the police feel like that they should dictate their own work terms. They should get to decide what equipment they use. They get to decide their standard operating procedures. They get to decide all this stuff. And somehow or another, the people that employ them, which is usually the city or the county at the local level, that they should butt out because they don't understand what they're doing. And I don't share that view. I believe that we can tell them what equipment to use. We can tell them how to deploy. We can tell them whether they ride bicycles or whether they walk a beat. And we can tell them what that they arrest for and what they give citations for. I believe that we can do that. But my view is not in the majority. My view is in a very, very small minority of people who share that view of what we can do with the police. The police win with public opinion that they should be able to determine all these things.
So you're the crackpot.
I'm the crackpot as far as that goes.
All right. On that note, we have to flip the tape.
Okay.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Outstanding. And we are back from our long... Did we take like a 30-minute break right there?
Or like close to an hour.
Okay. Let's see here. Let's cover this one really quick. The Brittany Zamora sentenced to 20 years in prison for sex with a teen student. Are you ready for that one?
Can't see a problem with it. Keep going.
You know, I often think about my own personal reflection here of being, you know, a young adolescent in my late high school years, that if a 20-something-year-old teacher were hitting on me, I would be ecstatic. The difference here, at least for this is a 28-year-old teacher and a 13-year-old boy. And we do often talk about teachers and they get incredibly light sentences. So this is someone that she's gotten 20 years in Maricopa County, which is Joe Arpaio's hometown. She got hit with a pretty strong sentence.
She did. And that was the purpose that at least I wanted to talk about this. It illustrates the harshness of some states. I'm assuming in order to be a teacher that she had no criminal record. And she said in her statement to the court, you know, that she had no criminal. She tried to live a law-abiding life and that she made a bad choice here. And clearly, I think it's a bad choice. We don't want teachers having sex with students in the K-12 system at any age, even if it's a 28-year-old teacher and an 18-year-old student. It's just not a good, healthy thing to be doing. But 20 years in prison is way disproportionate to the crime, way disproportionate. Now, if she'd have been one state over, if she'd have chosen to teach in New Mexico, it would be unheard of to give a first-time offender 20 years.
Really? What do you think? Can you speculate?
She would have probably gotten probation.
Really?
Yeah, she'd probably
gotten probation. Oh, my God. That's a night and day. I'm thinking you would say something like 5-ish or something.
No. Without any force. And I know anything underage is theoretically forced, but it's not forced if it was a consensual thing. Here, as a first-time offender of our 33 counties, I can't think of any county where she would have gotten a significant prison sentence. And at most, she would have probably gotten a probated sentence with no criminal history.
That's crazy.
She would have lost. No, it's not crazy at all. It's actually the way it should be.
I mean, crazy as in what my mind is of what the normal is in the United States you have there.
She would likely have gotten a probated sentence here, and that would be appropriate. We can monitor her with probation. Treatment is probably in order. She's probably got some issues related to her sexuality, and treatment would probably be effective in her case if it was real treatment, not the kabuki treatment that we have that's disguised as a collaborative fishing expedition in most sex offender arena of the treatment providers, where they work in collaboration to try to revoke the person. But this would be an adequate sentence. She would surrender her teaching license.
Yeah.
And she would have a chance to have her record eradicated so that at the age of 28, why do you want to destroy her life? Why do you want her to be a tax leech rather than a tax producer? How does that benefit us as society? Wouldn't we want her paying as much tax as we possibly can suck out of her for the rest of her life? I mean, since we have already a demographic problem in this country, every time we disable a person with a sex offense conviction, and even a felony conviction, but particularly a sexual offense conviction, we're diminishing the money that we can suck out of them exponentially. Why would you want to do that?
So she also says that while she is gone, let's see, I'm trying to find where it is, that, while she's gone, she wants to earn a new degree in prison so she can start another career when she is free once more.
Good luck in Arizona earning a degree.
I know, right? Good luck anywhere. We only recently talked that they are starting to pilot test bringing Pell Grants in. So unless she's got resources on the street for someone to send in correspondence course stuff, she's screwed.
So now, before I get any hate emails, I would be saying the same thing if it were a male. I know that the society would look at it differently. Because traditionally, the women teachers have gotten lighter sentences. Just look at Debbie LaFay and people that have been high-profile, sensationalized cases. They've generally gotten lighter sentences. But I would be saying the same thing. We don't want to destroy a 28-year-old male's life if this is aberrational behavior and it's not indicative of who they are. And we would want to try to save any 28-year-old. So I would not be saying anything differently if it was a 28-year-old male.
Right. It wouldn't make the news like this, though. That's for sure. So, I don't think. We should move on over and talk about Kevin Spacey. Do you think? You know, now that I think about it, this is the Kevin Spacey thing is... I shouldn't say it's similar, but it's the Jussie Smollett thing. It is, you know, there's parallels there of the way the evidence comes about, I suppose. I have a little news clip coming for this one. Go ahead.
Didn't you skip a clip?
I did. Hang on. So let's back up. We're going to talk about our good friend Antonin Scalia. You provided a clip for Antonin Scalia on the Second Amendment. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to skip that.
And plus, we got some important music to play.
Oh, man, I don't have that ready, Larry. I'm going to have to put that in after post.
So, okay.
Here's Scalia.
Let's turn to an issue that is in the news right now with the massacre in Colorado.
Obviously, this is a little bit old.
And that is gun control. You wrote in 2008 the opinion in District of Columbia v. Heller, the majority opinion that said the Second Amendment means what it says. People have a right to bear arms. Question, how far does that constitutional right go? Can a legislature ban semi-automatic weapons, or can it ban magazines that carry 100 rounds without violating an individual's constitutional right to bear arms?
What the opinion in Heller said is that it will have to be decided in future cases what limitations upon the right to keep and bear arms are permissible. Some undoubtedly are, because there were some that were acknowledged at the time. For example, there was a tort called affrighting, which if you carried around a really horrible weapon just to scare people, like a head axe or something, that was... I believe a misdemeanor. So, yes, there are some limitations that can be imposed. What they are will depend on what the society understood were reasonable limitations at the time. There were certain location limitations.
About these technological limitations? Obviously, we're not now talking about a handgun or a musket. We're talking about a weapon that can fire 100 shots in a minute.
We'll see. I mean... obviously, the amendment does not apply to arms that cannot be hand carried. It's to keep and bear, so it doesn't apply to cannons. But I suppose there are handheld rocket launchers that can bring down airplanes. That will have to be it'll have to be decided.
How do you decide that if you're a textualist?
Very carefully. my starting point and probably my ending point will be. What limitations are within the understood limitations that the society had at the time? They had some limitations on the nature of arms that could be borne. So we'll see what those limitations are as applied to modern weapons.
Larry, do you know what a Desert Eagle is?
No.
A Desert Eagle is a pistol that is a 50 caliber, and it is. I mean, effing huge. I mean, it is a giant round. It is what they use in sniper rifles to take out engine blocks. So when he says, well, I guess you couldn't have a cannon, a Desert Eagle is basically a hand cannon.
Well, the reason why I put this clip in here is I wanted people to hear him say several times, "We'll have to wait and see." When people ask about whether something can be done or not, and I say, "We don't know, we'll have to wait and see," they look at me and they roll their eyes and they do all kind of contortions. We truly don't know on some things. It's like we'll have to let the cases go up on appeal and we'll have to see where the limits are. The former justice, the late justice, has indicated that there are limitations on weapons that can be carried by individuals. The individual right is not complete and absolute. But we don't know where they are yet. They haven't been defined yet. We'll have to let states enact limitations, and the National Rifle Association will challenge those, and there'll be appellate case law, and something else will eventually go up to the Supreme Court, and they'll grant cert, and we'll find out. But that applies in other areas that we talk about what can be done. We just don't know. We don't know about polygraphs, how far they can go with polygraphs. We just don't know because the cases haven't gone up and we haven't drawn those boundaries. What we do know is that the Tenth Circuit on the polygraphs has said that something that will, like a person cannot be compelled to incriminate themselves. And I think they said that recently in the Seventh Circuit. I think we wrote about that recently and talked about it in the Seventh Circuit. But we just don't know what the answers to all these things. So when someone tells you we don't know, we truly don't know. You heard the Supreme Court justice saying, "We don't know." So that was why I wanted that to be in there. There are limits on where the Second Amendment can go in terms of. Now, he seems to have invented a limitation there. He says you have to be able to carry them. To bear arms. I don't remember seeing anything in the Second Amendment that says you have to be able to carry it. So he seems to have invented something that's not in the text that says that they have to be hand carried. Where is that anywhere written?
Does that by chance, is that what the bare arms means?
Well, maybe it does. But just if you're going by the text alone, it doesn't say that you can bear arms that can be carried. When they drafted the Constitution, were all arms carried, or did they drag some? I think they might have had them. They might have. I mean, so I don't know where he got that from.
The other thing, here
in the text.
I'm sure it is in your area too that people do open carry, like go into the restaurant or whatever.
Yes,
that intimidates me pretty bad. So he just said something that you can't have some sort of head chopper, whatever the hell he called it, as an intimidation weapon. Personally, I find anybody with a weapon on their hip is intimidating.
Even the police.
Definitely them. I know that they're loose cannons to begin with. Plus, they have extra rounds. They have tasers. They have handcuffs. I mean, they have all kinds of extra shit. Plus, they have radios, and they're going to get all their boys on you too.
Now, there went our podcast leak. We're going to be silenced now from saying that.
I know. I know.
But that
argument that just intrigues me of, so what they thought about weapons back in the 1700s, early 1800s, and how that covers us today. Right to bear arms. And he's talking about something of it being the size that you can carry. I was speaking to one of our listeners that happened to be in town this week today. And you could have a tactical nuke in a backpack. So, I mean, you could have a nuclear weapon in your backpack.
Well, like I say, we'll just have to wait and see where the limits are. There will be a flow of cases that will be requested by the Supreme Court, and we'll have to find out. Because as more and more Democrats get control of more and more legislative bodies, particularly at the city level, there will be more and more prohibitions enacted because that's all you can do at the local level if you don't have any national power, which the Democrats have very little national power right now. Then these cases will immediately, these statutes, these ordinances will immediately be challenged. And eventually the Supreme Court will give us more guidance in terms of where those limits are, in terms of where they can actually limit the right of the individual to carry. We just don't know yet. And when someone tells you we don't know, it's truly because we don't know. And I get so many angry stares when people ask me about, what's the court going to say? And I said, we don't know. We're going to have to wait and find out.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I know we can't get in the heads. I even asked Paul Dubling at the conference because he clerked for Gorsuch. And he actually even shut it down, saying, I'm not going to talk about any sort of private conversations that we had. I was just, can he illuminate anything of, since he was a person one-on-one with the guy? But he refused to, he declined to let me have
that
an answer.
That may be one of the commitments they make when they get a clerkship, is that they won't talk about their relations with justice. I don't know because I've never had that privilege, but that may be one.
I bet you could go toe-to-toe with a Scalia.
I would have a lot of fun with Scalia. I really would. I mean, It's like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but you know, they went toe to toe. I would love to, like it, that what he just said about. I would like to say, well, Justice, where did you get that text that it has to be in there? I mean, you say you're a textualist. Where is that in the text?
I do have a request for you. Then, as we move through the Scalia clips, I see that running for some length of time. Can we then move on to the next kind of justice? Can we move to an RBG?
Again, we don't find as much on her.
Yeah.
And she's not as articulate. Scalia is fun to soundbite because he says funny stuff.
Yeah.
And no one comes close to him when you find their clips. They're not as entertaining and they're not as articulate.
Right.
You know, disagree with him all you want, but he's very articulate.
Certainly, yeah. And you also wouldn't, you know, you could disagree with the policy. You would have a hard time. Same thing that I say about you, Larry. Like, we could disagree on our politics, but you're going to have to really come to the table with a lot of, like, solid points, with evidence, with, you know, not just like, because I said so, it feels right. Damn it. You're not going to be able to pull that off.
Well, and that's why I like soundbiting Scalia. But we can look for some if we look for Thomas, he's never said anything in the 20s.
I know, right? He only recently penned a decision for the first time like a couple months ago, and he hadn't done anything in 10 or 15 years or something.
I think that might be an overstatement, but he doesn't participate in oral argument, and he rarely says anything. So we'll have to rule him out. Same with Alito. He's really quiet, but we could probably get a lot out of Breyer if we looked for it. But Scalia is just, because him being a textualist and originalist, it makes it fun, because what I'm looking to do is to make sure you understand, if you say this is what you are, well, then there are downsides to being, there are upsides also, but there are also downsides, like the recent decisions we've talked about out of Colorado, out of Nebraska, Colorado and other states, where I say, well, that's a straight textualist decision. You know, you are a person, aren't you?
So, last time I checked. All right. Well, then let's move on to, I have a couple articles. I have one from the BBC, and then here's a YouTube clip on the good old Kevin Spacey.
To unexpected testimony in the case against actor Kevin Spacey, his accuser admitting to waiting 15 months to report the alleged incident. Prosecutors had said it was only 3 months. That was just the beginning of the questions that unraveled today, including what happened to the accuser's phone. Here's Lindsay Davis.
The case against Kevin Spacey in jeopardy tonight. His accuser taking the stand today, but then invoking his Fifth Amendment right after questions about whether he had deleted text messages, leading the judge to strike his testimony from the record. Spacey's lawyer pounced.
He's the sole witness that can establish the circumstances of his allegation on the night in question. This case needs to be dismissed, and I believe it needs to be dismissed today.
The judge seemed to agree, saying he wasn't sure if the case would continue or collapse. The accuser's mother, a former Boston TV anchor, admitted today,
I deleted a few things.
But she says she did not delete any texts relevant to the night in question. Another issue, the accuser's phone is missing. The House of Cards star is accused of groping the then 18-year-old in Nantucket in 2016. The 59-year-old actor has pleaded not guilty to a charge of indecent assault and battery. Just last week, the accuser dropped a civil lawsuit against Spacey.
As for that missing phone, a state trooper testified today that he returned the phone to the family but did not get a receipt. Now, both the accuser's father and mother testified that they don't know what happened to the phone. The judge set another hearing for the end of the month. David.
So, like, right at the beginning, it says that the accusation was from 3 months ago, but in fact it was 15 months ago? That's right off the bat. That's the first thing that caught my attention.
Yeah, this case is likely to collapse.
And so here's a guy that had been given, I think the number from, like, Netflix gave Kevin Spacey, and this was like a crapshoot. I think they said, here's $100 million, make this unprecedented show called House of Cards, which I think is a White House story. And I mean, it's off the charts successful. And this guy has been then removed from Netflix and all the shit. He's lost his career out of this, off of an allegation that is going to then, the whole thing is going to collapse, and all this on just a fabricated story, essentially.
Well, I don't think we can go that far to say it's fabricated, but what we can say is that the evidence doesn't support the allegations. And people lose sight of the fact that the burden is on the accusing died to prove. Spacey's not supposed to have to prove anything.
But in the process, even still, it's reasonable to say that he did grope the guy, but it doesn't mean it was an unwarranted or unappreciated, unapproved groping. Then all this stuff comes out because Kevin Spacey's worth a truckload of money. So here we can go maybe stir up some shit and maybe we can get him to settle. And Spacey says, no, I didn't do it. But in the aftermath, the collateral damages is he's effectively a ruined actor.
That could be likely the case. And that's where there's no justice for the person who suffers this harm. And that's where the scales have got out of balance. They have gotten out of balance because the person that brought the accusations probably doesn't have any financial resources to speak of. And that's meaning that if the case totally collapses, to the extent that you would have any redress, you generally don't. Prosecutors are immune for bringing charges, and on the civil side, sometimes you can end up having to pay costs if you brought a frivolous case. But prosecutors are going to be completely immune, so there's not going to be any recompense to Spacey for his reputation. All the state's going to say is, "Well, the case collapsed. You know, we didn't have the evidence," and then they're going to go out and try to find some other case where they have the evidence. That's what they're going to do.
Right. Yeah. So innocent until proven guilty, however, reputation completely destroyed in the process.
And this day of mob rule, that is kind of where we are. We've forgotten. And I wish for once I would hear a police and law enforcement agency, because they do it when their officers are accused of a crime. They always say, well, you haven't seen the whole story. It's not out. You haven't seen the whole story. I wish I could live long enough to hear a law enforcement say, we've brought our charges against this person. We believe they did it, but they will have a story to tell. And we haven't heard the other side yet. And they're still presumed innocent, although we think that we have the evidence to convict them. I'm waiting for that day.
And, you know,
I bet I'll be waiting for a long time, but they certainly... an officer has no hesitation to say, well, you haven't heard my side of the story.
Right.
All you've heard is all this innuendo. And you wait till my side comes out. But they never say that about the people they accuse. They never say, well, let's just wait till we hear their side of the story.
I also like when you do those little mock-up voices and you go, well. I think we're now down to our feature segment, Larry, which is very complicated and very emotionally charged. And this is a story of two underaged people engaged in some drunken activities at a high school party. And of course, only one of them is going to get charged. But this is a drive the bus. I'll ask you questions as we go. But this is I don't know. This is disturbing, and it seems like kind of like kids doing kids things. And yes, there's some damage in the end of it, but ultimately the super damage is what's going to happen to the boy in the case.
Well, this is a case out of the state of New Jersey.
Oh, New Jersey. Sorry. Why do I say Colorado?
Probably because I have stuff in the case and the registry matters file related to Colorado. But this particular one is out of New Jersey. And it's the case where the judge said that he was from a good family. And so the issue on this case is the juvenile male who was 16 at the time of the allegation, there was a motion put forth by the state to transfer, to do what they call a waiver in New Jersey, to move him out of family court and into adult court, where he would be subject to adult penalties. And the judge denied the state on that waiver. And on July 3rd of 2018, after a several-day waiver hearing, a family court judge, over the course of approximately 2 hours and 65 transcript pages, denied the waiver. Now, what that tells me, as someone who works in the defense, that New Jersey has a process to determine if a juvenile can be waived up to adult court, because you wouldn't have a several-day hearing if it was something where the prosecutor just checked a box and said, I'm moving them to adult court. So we can infer from this that there's a process. And if for the judge to take 2 hours to read his reasoning, that means that there was a fairly significant amount of evidence taken in that hearing, that there was testimony and evidence. But the charges arose, the juvenile initials or GMC, that he took advantage sexually of a female who was supposedly unconscious. That's the allegation. And the prosecutor in Monmouth County wanted to try this youngster as an adult. And the judge denied the motion. And he made some very, very insensitive comments in the process, which in the decision I've made some highlights in the document, some of the stuff that was said. And one of the comments was that he had good family support and came from, you know, he was a good student, and you know, he basically was saying he has a future. That did not set well with the community. So there's been a very, very strong response against the judge. And this could turn into another Judge Persky situation, which was the one in California with Brock Turner.
Yeah.
Because of the judge said that he took those factors into consideration. Now, I'm not fully up to date. I didn't do enough research to know exactly what the standards are in New Jersey to move a person, a juvenile, to adult court. But in the opinion, it doesn't look like it's as significant as in my state. In my state, it's pretty significant. You have to go through a lot of hoops to move a juvenile to adult court, and it's an amenability hearing, and the juvenile has to be determined that they're not amenable to rehabilitation of any facility or resources that are available anywhere within the state. And that's a pretty tough, tall order for the prosecution to meet. So it's very difficult to move a person to a juvenile court. And those long-term podcast listeners will hear me say that even Cody Posey, who was the a juvenile 14-year-old who killed three people, his father and his mother and his sister, Sam Donaldson's ranch here in New Mexico, they couldn't even move Cody to adult court. So that tells you a little something about the barriers.
Right.
Well, I'm assuming that New Jersey's barriers must not be quite as high, but there must be some barriers there, or you wouldn't need a several day hearing. What really disturbs me is that people don't understand that family support is a part of the amenability process. If you're taking a person that you're not going to send away for life, and you're possibly going to put them in a juvenile facility for a few years, and here we can keep them in a juvenile facility till they're 21. You might not want to keep them till they're 21. You might want to keep them till they're 20 and have some community supervision. The level of family support and how good of a student they are, where they are as an individual, that would be a relevant factor to consider. A person who's in the crack ghetto, who's a complete failure in their studies and has absolutely nothing going for them, they're probably not going to be as amenable to rehabilitation as someone who's been excelling in academics and who has a good, strong support system in place. So that would be a legitimate factor. Now, you'd have to be very crafty at how you word that when you issue your findings, but I don't know why people are so angry about that being a consideration. That boggles my mind that you would not understand that a person who has a good, strong support system would be more amenable, likely more amenable to rehabilitation if they've demonstrated that they've been able to comply with discipline. He had some aberrational conduct here, as it appears. He did some stupid things, 16-year-old boys, and it was pretty obnoxious. Not only did he have the sex allegedly, but he videoed it and he distributed it.
That seems to have been done post intoxication too.
Yes. Well, but we've heard presidents of the United States brag about stuff that they said that they've done. And
that's okay, so, though.
If we can cut slack for people doing locker room talk. Now, clearly, if he actually did it, this is not locker room talk. If this young man actually did this stuff, and apparently the evidence is pretty compelling that he did. But a 16-year-old is not going to have the same judgment that someone who's older in terms of knowing the ramifications of that. We would certainly want to have a significant intervention with him. But to decide to write his life off, to put him in adult court because of this, to me, without any, just because of the severity and the distastefulness of the allegations, if that's your sole deciding factor, then you don't need a process. You just need to give the prosecutor a box to check. Say, I find the allegations to be horrendously serious. Therefore, I'm checking this box and they're going to adult court. What's the purpose of having a process?
So I wonder, though, is it insensitive to say that they both went to the party probably knowing that there was going to be alcohol? I mean, so I guess actually the question that I wanted to ask you first was, can we cover the concept of rape again? The judge said it in this also about what would be the quote unquote definition of rape.
I don't know the New Jersey statute of what he, but
oh,
the judge
that's
said,
true. Okay.
That still in my mind, distinguish between sexual assault and rape. In my mind, there is a distinction. So, the judge seems to give an opinion that those who do crazy stuff when they're intoxicated, it's not, that's not a traditional rape. That seems to be his choice of words.
Yeah. And you do have it highlighted on page 3. It says, in my mind, the traditional case of rape, all right, where there are generally two or more males involved, generally at gunpoint or a weapon, clearly manhandling person into an area where there was nobody around. In my mind, that's what I think of rape also. I don't think of this as being rape when people are complicit in what's going on. And I'm not saying she was complicit, because if she was drunk, but I don't want to victim blame. I really struggle with these things and figure out where to draw the line, because she did drink, you know, you are human. You did drink the alcohol. Did you not think there would be no consequences for what happens after that? But that's victim blaming.
Well, yeah, you just set off every victim's advocacy organization that's out there to descend on us. But a person being intoxicated is no justification to go forward with an unconsensual. In fact, a mature mind would say this is exactly the wrong time. But that's a mature mind that doesn't have sexual urges that might could come to that conclusion. I would say that there's probably males out there that are much more mature than a 16-year-old that when someone gets intoxicated, they probably have gone beyond where they should have gone and gotten away with it. And I'm not justifying it at all. I'm saying totally, it's completely wrong. I don't want to have sex with anybody who doesn't want to have sex with me. I want them totally into it. To me, if they're not totally into it, it's not any fun. But that's the way I look at it. And of course, since I'm so old now, that there's not a whole lot of people that are totally into having sex with me, so that's not a problem.
There are graveyards that have willing participants for you.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's called necrophilia.
I'm not familiar with that. Personal experience when I had
no. Well, my dad did own a funeral home growing up, so not personally, but I've heard stories.
But remember, we've got a 16-year-old here, and everybody claims that the mind of a male doesn't get fully matured till 25. Okay, well, he's 9 years less than fully matured on his brain development. If I take you at your word that that's where the mind fully develops, and if adults are going to exercise poor discretion, I think we could cut a little bit of slack without justifying his behavior. But intervention can take place. He doesn't have to go to prison for the rest of his life to make a strong statement. That's what people confuse here. Somehow or another, if you don't send this boy away for the rest of his life, you haven't provided justice. I would say just the opposite. If you send this boy away long enough that we get him the intervention that he needs so he recognizes the gravity of his behavior and he never misbehaves again, and he goes out and works and pays taxes for the rest of his life, I'd say it's a win-win for everybody.
Right.
But maybe I'm just looking at it wrong.
Sure. Do you think that there's any component in here about the moving it to adult court based on race?
I saw a comment posted
from someone else in reading a thread, so I just wanted to bring it up.
I saw that comment, and again, I don't like to make accusations without evidence. Racism is a serious thing, and it does occur. But racism is something that should not be played as a card without evidence, because it diminishes the claim when there is. We have no evidence of that here.
Okay.
Systemically, we know that the income and the clout of minorities is generally less than the majority, generally less. I've known some people in the minority. In fact, there's a young man dead now that got a very good outcome here. He got a conditional discharge for some very significant crimes here in Bernalillo County. And he used to be my server at Applebee's, and he ended up, unfortunately, he did not respond well to the rehabilitative efforts of the conditional discharge, and he got back into drugs and ended up dead at 24 years old. And so we don't have any evidence of that. But what we do have evidence of is that he was from a fluent background, and generally people with from a fluent background can muster the resources to make the arguments more cogently. I doubt a person with a public defender would have been able to have a several-day hearing through that process of transferring him to adult court, because the public defender system in most states and probably New Jersey is so overwhelmed that they just wouldn't have had that type of resource to devote to it. So I would say that being the luck of the winning the ovarian lottery, that he came from a fluent background that he probably would have, race would have played a factor because of his affluence. But I don't think that, without any evidence, I'm not willing to say, well, the judge would have denied that if it had been a black juvenile. I'm not ready to say that. I don't have any evidence that supports that, and I don't want to throw that out there, but I did hear it on the listserv.
Sure.
I did see it.
Yeah. And I just wanted to approach it just to see, because, I mean, there was one person that was saying that this is the most abhorrent behavior that could be possible, and this person should be thrown under the bus and then have the whole bus department drive over it.
Well, and that was one of our state advocates. I'm not going to name the name, but that was our state advocates that said that.
Yeah, I know.
And that really distressed me, because I'm so hardwired for defense that I can't imagine that someone who's in advocacy would take that posture to throw a 16-year-old under the bus and say that because of exercising some very poor judgment that we should write off this life. I'm not ready to do that.
Right. Yeah. No, I understand. I understand. Yeah. And I think one of the affiliates was like, hey, it's a minor. That's just the end of the conversation.
That's the end of the conversation because he's a minor?
Correct. Like, he should be in juvenile court, and that's just the end of it.
Well, and I don't take that hard. I don't take that hard. I think that the system we have in our state is probably the best one, that you do a full evaluation on the state's dime if the person can't afford it, and you figure out if they're amenable to any resource we have. After that inquiry has been done, a judge makes a decision on amenability, and if they're not amenable, they go into adult court because they're incorrigible. But I don't like for people to be deemed incorrigible just because of what they've done, which is what people are clamoring for here, because this is a distasteful thing. Having someone intoxicated and having sex with them and making videos, that's very distasteful.
Sure. Sure.
It's beyond distasteful. It's abhorrent behavior, and that can't be condoned. But even in juvenile court, it's not being condoned.
Right.
It's not as if he's being told, well, you did just fine, buddy boy. We're going to hold you for 30 days and you can go home and forget this ever happened. That's not what's going to happen if he's treated as a juvenile.
The one thing before we wrap up that I wanted to bring up is one of the things, you know, they do sort of like home surveys or you know, even if you're doing an interstate compact, they check out to see if you're stable, you know, job, family stuff to do an interstate compact. They do a similar kind of check if you're going to be released from prison early. So how isn't that sort of the same thing? Are you going to go into a stable environment when you get out of prison? So here, this kid is growing up in a stable environment. Why trash him on the front side?
That was kind of the argument that I was making. It is a relevant factor. And I can't help that the world is the way it is, and we have a lot of disadvantaged youth that would not have that support structure. But that doesn't mean, I mean, I'm going straight into the conservatives, to their philosophy. We wouldn't want to bring everybody down to the same level just because some people are there. What we would want to do would be to try to build those people up. And that would mean expenditure of resources to give the people that are from the disadvantaged background who are living in the ghetto, who would not have the support structure, to give them, we would have to provide resources to make them have a better opportunity for rehabilitation. But it doesn't mean deny rehabilitation to anybody else that happens to have those. To me, that's the craziest thing I've heard.
Right. And that would be the other side. So if this person came from a family of not so much means, that person then gets to get trashed because they don't have that same level of support, versus this person that does have the support, they don't get trashed. That doesn't seem fair either.
It isn't fair, but I'm saying that's the reality of life. I'm not saying it's fair, but if a person has no support system, it's tougher to rehabilitate them as a juvenile. You need the cooperation of the parental unit. That's a part of the rehabilitation plan. You keep them in a facility for a while, then you reintegrate them into a community. You very rarely, in our state, we very rarely hold them in the CY, Children, Youth, and Families Department, whatever that the acronym is. We very rarely hold them until their 21st birthday. We hold them for part of the time, and then we begin to reintegrate them into the community. And the stronger their support system is, the more easily it is to reintegrate them and oversee them. If you've got nobody to work with you at CYFD, then they're not an attractive candidate to reintegrate. Doesn't mean you don't try, but it just puts them at a disadvantage. I don't write the rules for life.
Yeah, I understand.
I tell people, I didn't set up the system we have. We right. have a system where we have haves and we have have-nots. And, you know, they chose the wrong parents to be born with. And, you know.
So somewhere along the path, you said, yes, I would like those persons and that person. And yes, that's who I want to be my parents. That's how it works.
That's correct. I mean, if you choose your parents correctly, you get to go to better schools. You get to
it's got to be like going to the, it's like got to be going to the PetSmart where they do the adoption day, and you get to look around at the people coming through and you wag your tail and be all cute to the one that you think is going to be the right one.
Well, in the case of an animal, you do get to choose your own human.
To a degree.
But of course, they're so desperate that they choose anybody that seems nice to them to get out of those cages. But that's the disadvantage of our system, is that people who have the misfortune of growing up in these very bad familial situations, it's more difficult to rehabilitate them, even in the best of models. Now, we don't give up trying here.
Okay.
But it's more difficult because you don't have that support that you need from the family. It's like I hear these conversations about, well, they ought not be teaching that. The parents ought to teach that. That ain't for the schools. Well, but there's parents who are not capable, who are so dysfunctional, they barely can survive through the day with their crack fix or whatever they're doing. They're not going to teach their kids about safe sex and all this kind of stuff that you think they ought to be doing. So I guess you would just prefer to leave them out because the parents ought to be doing it. The truth is the parents are not doing a lot of things they ought to be doing. And a lot of cases, these kids have not had the parental supervision and guidance that they should have had, and they've misbehaved and they've acted out because of lack of parental guidance and supervision. Well, does that mean that we write them off? No, it just means it's more difficult and we have to provide a greater level of rehabilitative options for them. We may have to spend some precious money of the taxpayers to have more facilities and more coaching and more mentorship for those kids who come from broken homes and from dysfunctional backgrounds. I said the tax word.
I know right now, again. So I ran off everybody with the victims advocates comments, and earlier we ran them off because of this comment. Now we're off to we're going to be down to zero before next week, Larry.
Well, we're pretty close now. I heard. How did we do in the last week? Well, actually, we didn't do nothing last week, so we had zero listeners because we didn't do a recording.
I did that so I could pad the numbers better, and so it's a 2-week span that I'm tracking statistics instead of just one.
All right, so.
Well. Are we done, Larry? Have we run off everybody and we can be done? Closed up shop?
I hope so. And I think we should just tell folks that we're sorry we missed you last week. But
absolutely.
Vacation was in order for my co-host here. And he has family and he has things that distracted him. And I was glad to have a week off, but we certainly missed being here. I did.
I was like, what am I supposed to do Saturday? That's right. And then I was like, I don't have to do anything.
Oh, but we don't miss very often.
No, I have no intentions on doing that. Hey, I'm not a slacker. That is not true. Someone in Discord says that I'm a damn slacker. I'm gonna hurt you, person. Well, Larry,
we're gonna disconnect them from our end.
Yes, we've been trying to figure out how to use that. Yes, Captain Crazy, you can find him on Twitter. Captain Crazy, we're going to disconnect you on our end. I have methods and ways of doing such things.
Now, I guess we shouldn't disconnect him if he's a patron, though.
He is a patron.
Well, I guess we better not disconnect that one.
Damn it. Okay, so if you want to be disconnected from our end, you have to not be a supporter. All right, then. Brenda, then that means you're on the chopping block. All right, then. Larry, where can people go to find the podcast?
Oh, let's see. I think that's registrymatters.co.
Do you have any idea why I named it CO?
I have no idea. Why don't you tell
me? Me neither. I have no idea. I don't remember why I made it a CO and not a .com. I have no idea. How about the phone number? We didn't get any voicemail this week.
I love that. 747, like the airplane, 227-4477.
Awesome. 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 And if they want to send in an email message?
Send it directly to Andy at registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And also, if you have it, if you want it to go to Larry, I will certainly send it. And then about supporting the podcast, what is the best way?
Oh, well, no one's ever taken me up on it, so I'm going to quit saying it. So just go to patreon.com and feel inspired to make a financial commitment of as little as a dollar or any amount that your budget will permit.
Outstanding. And that's patreon.com/registrymatters.
That's what I believe it is. Yes.
Yes. All right. Well, then we're going to get out of here. I'm going to go get a Frosty or a Blizzard from Dairy Queen. So I'm not going to stick around.
How do the people join us for the recording? Because that's I like to see hundreds of people here.
You would have to go check out the show notes. They're in every episode you can find. There's a link to the Discord server if you want to come hang out.
And if you want information, if you happen to live in Tennessee, what we talked about earlier about the temporary restraining order, we have the order at NARSL, whatever that website is. We have the order available on the NARSL website.
Go to just NARSL.org and you'll find it.
And we have a little article that Sandy and I have written about it. And then do we have the audio of that interview with Mr. McNally yet?
Yeah, I've released everything today.
All right. So you could actually hear the second hour of the conference call where we focused on Tennessee. So that's what you should do. We can't give you legal advice, but read the order. And if you have any concerns, contact the agency that told you to move, to leave home. And we believe you might be able to return.
Awesome. And so with that, Larry, I bid you adieu, and I hope you have a wonderful weekend, and I will talk to you soon. Good night, everybody.
Thanks. Good night.
Bye.
You're listening to FYP.